ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, it's a beautiful day for fishing. That was the final message sent by Colombian man Alejandro Carranza Medina to his family just hours before he was killed in a US strike near Venezuela. America insists he was smuggling drugs, but the family's demanding compensation, and you'll hear from their lawyer shortly. Also ahead, remember the GFC? Back then, Wayne Swan was the federal treasurer whose stimulus package saved us from recession. His global peers considered him a bit of a rock star, even as he was mocked by the coalition. As Wayne Swan retires from active duty with life membership of the ALP in his pocket, he's sounding a warning. Imagination is the secret to a successful government. And the festive season is upon us, and that means it's time for the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra's annual Noel Noel concert, which this year has a Spanish theme.
Por las alamedas de la vendimia, alumbrando el vino se va febrero.
Absolutely beautiful. What a time of year. I speak with the orchestra's artistic director, Paul Dyer, and two of the stars of the concert will perform just for you. First up, President Donald Trump and his war secretary, Pete Hegseth, have again sought to justify military strikes in the Caribbean against boats that they say are engaged in smuggling drugs to the US. Reports that Pete Hegseth ordered troops to, quote, kill everybody on one boat have prompted concern among service members that they could be asked to carry out orders that are illegal. And Republican Senator Rand Paul has sharply criticised the Defence Secretary for defending a secondary strike on survivors, declaring him either incompetent or a liar. But at a cabinet meeting alongside President Trump, Pete Hegseth defended his orders, declaring there were narco-terrorists on board.
The first couple of strikes, as you would, as any leader would want, you want to own that responsibility. So I said, I'm going to be the one to make the call after getting all the information and make sure it's the right strike. That was September 2nd. There's a lot of intelligence that goes into that, building that case and understanding that a lot of people providing information. I watched that first strike live. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting. A couple of hours later, I learned that that commander had made the, which he had the complete authority to do, and by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat. And it was the right call. We have his back, and the American people are safer because narco-terrorists know you can't bring drugs through the water and eventually on land if necessary to the American people. We will eliminate that threat and we're proud to do it.
So you didn't see any survivors, to be clear, after that first strike?
I did not personally see survivors, but I stand, because the thing was on fire. It was exploded and fire is smoke. You can't see anything. You got digital. This is called the fog of war.
More than 83 people have died since the US campaign began, with 21 separate operations since early September. The family of one of those killed, a Colombian national, has now taken legal action against the US government. Alejandro Carranza Medina was killed on September the 15th. Daniel Kovalik is a lawyer based in the US who's acting on behalf of the family. I spoke with Daniel Kovalik earlier.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel, you've recently been to Colombia to meet with Alejandro's family. Tell us a little bit about them. Who are they and who was their father?
For lack of a better word, I mean, they're very simple, poor people. I met with his adult daughter, his wife, and their three little children. And honestly, you know, they weren't expecting this. You know, they were still in shock when I met them. It's been very hard. They lost their main breadwinner. They lost their father, their husband, and they're still grieving very much from all this.
What do they say that their father was doing on that Venezuelan boat when it was struck by a missile?
First of all, I'm not sure it was a Venezuelan boat. It was his boat. I mean, he's from Santa Marta.
And it was his boat.
Yeah, he was fishing for marlin and tuna. That's what he does. He was a fisherman. And in fact, the last they heard from him, he was out on the ocean or out on the Caribbean Sea, and he said, "It's a beautiful day for fishing." And I never heard from him again.
On that day, the 15th of September, the US President Donald Trump posted a social media message claiming that American military forces had conducted the strike, quote, after positively identifying extraordinarily violent drug trafficking cartels and narco-terrorists. He also attached a video of the strike. And when he was asked at a press conference that day about the evidence that the Americans were relying on to justify the attack, here's what he said.
Well, we have proof. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was, like, it's spattered all over the ocean. Big bags of cocaine and fentanyl all over the place. And it was, plus we have recorded evidence that they were leaving. We've recorded them. It's very careful because we know you people would be after us. We're very careful.
Big bags of fentanyl and cocaine spattered all over the place. That doesn't sound like marlin.
Well, but I don't believe Trump. In fact, Pete Hegseth himself admitted at one point he has no idea who these people are they're killing. How would they know? This is absurd. And by the way, even assuming that some of these people killed were transporting drugs, you can't just murder people who you claim are trafficking in drugs. You know, in my city, people traffic in drugs. You can't just go up to them and shoot them in the head because you say they're drug traffickers. This is absurd. And by the way, you just saw Donald Trump pardoned the former president of Honduras who was trafficking drugs into the United States. This has nothing to do with drugs.
I want to come back to that, what this does have to do with in your view. But you talked to the family. Did you ask them, did their father, Alejandro Carranza, have any history of working with the cartels or have a criminal record?
I didn't ask them that in particular. I said, what was he doing? They said he was a fisherman. And he was in the Fishermen's Association. The head of the Fishermen's Association vouched for him as well. As far as they knew, all he was doing was fishing.
You've filed this petition now.
And by the way, let me say one other thing. His boat could not even reach the United States without being refueled 20 times. I mean, whatever he was doing had no bearing on the United States, was no threat to the United States.
So tell us, if you can, about this petition that you filed on behalf of the family with the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights, the IACHR. What's the basis of their petition?
The only basis you can bring against the United States is under the American Declaration of the Rights of Man, which is maybe the first human rights instrument ever agreed to in 1948 in Bogota, Colombia. And I allege that this killing violated a number of provisions of that, the right to life, the right to due process, the right to trial. Claim is that this was murder. This was an extrajudicial killing. And that's what it was. No one can dispute that, right? I mean, the best Trump could say is he killed people who were doing bad things. But you know what? You can't just kill people. You need to try them. You need to convict them. And by the way, even in the U.S., even in states that have the death penalty, trafficking in drugs would not get you the death penalty. It's not a capital crime. So there's literally no legal basis for this at all.
And in the petition you filed, did you, on behalf of the family, specifically identify Pete Hegseth, the U.S. Defense Secretary, as the perpetrator of this crime that you allege?
Yes, because we know that he has ordered these killings. We know that he has given orders to kill everyone on board. So we named him and Trump, who's ratified the conduct of Pete Hegseth. So this goes to the very top.
Daniel, what does the family want?
Compensation, for sure. But they also want the killings to stop. So we want compensation, but also, injunctive relief, telling the U.S. to stop murdering people.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Daniel Kovalik. He's a U.S. lawyer representing a Colombian family whose father was killed in a U.S. airstrike on September the 15th. Daniel, more broadly, you've worked in human rights. You understand U.S. foreign policy in the region well. How unprecedented is this action, such an overt action by the U.S. military, blowing up alleged drug boats?
I would say it's unprecedented and how brazen it is. Obviously, the killing spree that the U.S. has been involved in Latin America for the last decades is quite amazing, right?
I mean, there's been plenty of U.S. covert operations aimed at subverting governments in the region.
Right, and aimed at supporting right-wing death squads that have killed and disappeared hundreds of thousands of people. But this is so overt, right? The U.S. generally, not since the early 20th century, have they just openly engaged in murder, right? They usually do it through proxies, through agents, not this out in the open.
So what's motivating Donald Trump here then? Because the polls, the latest polls, show that there's not even close to majority support for this policy by the Trump administration.
What is he doing exactly? One thing I think he's doing is trying to divert attention from the faltering economy in the United States. And by the way, you know, most U.S. presidents, when they get into trouble, go to war. I'm sure that's not unique to U.S. presidents, but I happen to know them better.
It's a pretty extreme distraction, though, if that's what it is. It's pretty extreme.
Yeah, but, you know, they used to say about Bill Clinton that he, you know, he bombed Iraq every time the Monica Lewinsky scandal was flaring up. So it's not unprecedented in that way. But also, look, I think he's terrorizing the northern coast of South America. He's terrorizing Venezuela. He's terrorizing Colombia. He wants regime change, certainly in Venezuela. I think he may want it in Colombia as well. And I think he's terrorizing the population, you know, because if you can just blow people up in the high seas, it sends a message that there are no limits. There are no moral or legal limits to what the U.S. could do to people.
Venezuela's President Maduro, overwhelmingly lost the last election but remains in place. There's death squads, there's corruption, there's protests. But why is Donald Trump so intent on regime change there? What's that about?
Well, first of all, I'd question some of those premises. But what is the U.S. interested in? Oil, oil, and oil. As Noam Chomsky said when the U.S. was invading Iraq, they would never have done it if Iraq's main export were cabbage. And that is true with Venezuela, which has the largest oil reserves in the world.
Do you expect that there's some kind of deal being done here? I mean, those Venezuelan reserves, as you say, the largest in the world, have not been exploited to date by anybody. What do you think might be on the table here?
Well, I think he does want to overthrow the government in Venezuela, to put in power someone like Maria Corina Machado. She said if she were president, she would open the country up to trillions of dollars of exploitation. That's the type of person the U.S. would like to put in power.
The U.S. president has now threatened a land invasion of Venezuela. Do you think that's likely? And what would the impact of that be?
Look, a ground invasion would be insane. There are millions of people who've signed up to the militia to defend Venezuela. This would be another Vietnam. Now, is Trump capable of starting another Vietnam? Perhaps. But it would be foolhardy for the United States to try to do that. So we'll see. But, you know, again, who can predict the mind of Donald J. Trump? I wish I could.
At the same time, you know, through his immigration policies, Donald Trump regularly labels Hispanic people, particularly the undocumented migrants, as criminals, violent people who are just seeking to take advantage of the U.S.
Well, yes. I mean, it seems that Donald Trump is at war with Latinos. I mean, that's the only one conclusion one could draw. And ironically, given that he had a lot of Latinos turn out to vote for him, it's a very unhinged policy. And by the way, if he cares about immigration, a war on Venezuela would set off a huge wave of migration to the United States, right? So there's no discernible policy here, except, again, the goal to loot Venezuela of its resources. That's the only plausible explanation.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour, and my guest is lawyer Daniel Kovalik, who's filed a petition to the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights on behalf of the family who say that their husband and father was killed in a U.S. airstrike on the 15th of September. So, Daniel, this petition, what power does the commission have to do anything?
Well, the truth is it doesn't have tons of power because the U.S. has refused to ratify a number of agreements that would give the the commission power over it, but it has a certain moral authority to recommend compensation and injunctive relief to refrain from these types of killings. And I think that combined with public pressure could change the situation. And that's what we're hoping.
There's no sign yet, though, is there, that Donald Trump is likely to cave to the notion of paying this family compensation? I mean, they're certainly hanging tough in terms of their policy.
Well, we're pretty early on, aren't we, to draw that conclusion. There is a wave of criticism of these killings in the Caribbean and now the Pacific. There's a wave of criticism of Pete Hegseth. I actually think there is a tide turning against this policy in a very big way.
Daniel Kovalik, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Daniel Kovalik is an American human rights, labor rights lawyer and political activist based in Pittsburgh. He's currently representing the family of a Colombian citizen who was killed by a U.S. strike on his fishing boat, is how the family describes it. Coming up, it's the most wonderful time of the year. Artistic director of the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra, Paul Dyer, joins me along with a handful of his musicians with a teaser of their forthcoming Noel Noel concert. Stay tuned for that.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
Former Treasurer Wayne Swan was awarded life membership of the Labor Party over the weekend, capping a long, active political career with the ALP as political staffer, state secretary, the member for Lilly in Brisbane, and Treasurer of Australia in the Rudd and Gillard governments. In 2008, as Treasurer, Wayne Swan devised a $10 billion stimulus package as Australia's first response to the global financial crisis. That included, famously, checks to households and, of course, other measures that ultimately helped stave off recession in Australia, unlike many similar economies. That strategy earned him the title World's Best Treasurer by Euromoney magazine in 2011, a plaudit mocked at the time by the coalition when the Treasurer failed to deliver his promised surplus. For the past 7 years, Wayne Swan has been national president of the ALP, a post he'll relinquish next year after Labor's historic landslide victory at the last election. But he leaves the post with a warning to his party, not to be complacent, that survival depends on a new brand of politics and a revived Labor Party membership. Wayne Swan, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you, Fran. It's good to talk to you.
Wayne, there's good news and bad news, really, as you prepare to exit political life. On one hand, Labor's riding high, a landslide victory, its biggest parliamentary majority in 80 years. At the same time, overall support for both major parties is in the doldrums. Which matters more?
Well, what matters more is the policy that the government follows and that it implements over time. But you're right, we've got a record majority, and that majority can't just be a trophy to admire. That majority has to be used as a tool to fix things. And I believe the government will use it as a tool to fix things because we have in this country, I think over the last 40 years, achieved something pretty spectacular. The country has grown reasonably strongly, and it's grown with a greater degree of economic and social equity than just about any other advanced economy around the globe. So that's something to be proud of. I think Australia stands tall on the global stage, but also simultaneously there are insidious and frightening trends in politics. And we see this trend to what you'd call the extreme right. You see the fracturing of the primary votes of the major parties. And we have to always be aware that if you're going to have a record majority, then you've actually got to put in place the policies that ensure that you're re-elected and that you can deal with the fragmentation in the political system and the drift to the hard right.
That fracturing of primary votes for the major parties, though, would you call that insidious or would you describe that as a response to whatever the major parties are delivering and, you know, given the lack of enthusiasm that vote suggests, they're not delivering what matters?
Well, I think all political parties have a very big job ahead of them to motivate, to get new people involved in politics and to inspire people that a political life is an honourable life and an honourable political life can change a country. And one of the reasons that I'm in the Labor Party is that we've had a series of leaders from Gough right through to the current day who have seized the moment and put in place over a long period of time transformative programs, which has lifted living standards and lifted the quality of our life. And I think that the Albanese government is precisely in that position now and can go on to do that. But you can't take your vote for granted at any stage, particularly in an environment where we're seeing the sort of fracturing we are in the United States and elsewhere across Europe.
And we are seeing, for some, living standards having dropped, and we are also seeing younger generations looking at their futures and understanding and expecting that they will have a less affluent future than their parents. I mean, that is an extremely significant moment in this country. I mean, to quote your own words back to you, Labor's victory at the last election was wide but shallow. So when you hear the Prime Minister talk about making Labor the natural part of government in Australia, I wonder if that worries you, because isn't that about going wide, being everything to everyone?
No, I don't believe we can be everything to everyone. I think we need to be a very effective Labor Party that creates prosperity and spreads opportunity. And we have done well through our first and second term in addressing that maintenance, if you like, of prosperity and spreading the opportunity. But there's no question that the government faces some huge challenges, particularly in the area of housing and also in the energy transition. So marked progress on both those fronts is absolutely essential for the country, but if you like, for the political health of the government as well. Because politics is also about a compare and contrast. And if we look at what's going on the other side of politics, we don't see any attempt to grapple with what are complex policy problems and challenges, not just in the short term, but in the long term.
Housing, energy, transition, you know, renewables, climate change, call it what you like, immigration. These were all issues that were really around and controversial and divisive and difficult when you were in government. What does that tell you? As you sort of look at that, what does that tell you? And does it tell you that there's been a lot of missed opportunities, including when you're in government?
Well, what it tells me is we had a very big housing program in government, and that was part of our stimulus, Fran. So that's been lost in the current debate.
But what I mean is housing remains a problem. So, yes, sure, you may have spent on it, but
And the point was, the point is, on housing, we had a decade of a lack of action. The last Labor government did a very substantial stimulus through its affordable housing programs, and we're very proud of it. And this current government is doing that now. It is going to have to do a lot more of it. And also the energy transition, which, Fran, you will remember, was trenchantly opposed by the Liberal and National parties, who have now become even worse, if you like, on the whole issue of climate change and support for renewable energy. So this is a debate which we have to continue to have, and it's one that we have to win, because there is no future in this country without actually making the necessary investments in renewable energy and making sure that we have affordable housing for all of our citizens. They are huge challenges for this government, and we've got to this point because we had principally 10 years of neglect before we were elected. And we've got to this position because also on the conservative side of politics, we're seeing a fracturing and a trend towards, if you like, the elevation of cultural issues over issues of economic opportunity. And as a Labor Party, our view is that first and foremost, we're a party which is about economic opportunity, spreading that across the country, across all the age groups and all the various income levels is our number one objective.
Tell me more about that, what you mean by that, a trend to recognise cultural issues over economic opportunity, economic prosperity. Are you suggesting that the Labor Party, for instance, or the Labor government, you know, or are you warning it not to get too into identity politics? Is that what you're saying? And is that what's happened?
I don't need to warn them about that, but I've spoken about
it. Have they fallen into that trap in your
view? No, I don't believe they have it all, but that's the trap that the Conservative parties have fallen into. And they're playing identity politics even with the energy transition, which is just ridiculous, but they are. So, you know, I often explain it this way. When Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech and that with that great march in Washington, people missed the fact that it was entitled actually Jobs and Freedom. My point is that or equality, whether it's gender equality or racial equality, nothing is solvable unless it has a bedrock of economic opportunity underneath it. And I'm very proud of the fact that in this country, principally because of Labor governments, not just through a progressive tax system, but through our commitment to Medicare, to the social safety net, to decent industrial wages and working conditions, that we've laid the base in this country for the maintenance of a greater degree of equity here than you'll see in just about any other Western country.
Yes,
because we've always prioritised as Labor governments economic opportunity first and foremost.
But to come to the here and now, former Labor staffer Sean Kelly has a major piece in the latest quarterly essay suggesting Labor, or basically warning Labor, against losing its progressive bent as it strives to be the party of government. As I said, Anthony Albanese has said that's the aim, to try and hang on to that centre, that majority. He said pragmatism, his pitch is that pragmatism can effectively kill off courageous policy and passion. What does the Labor Party of the future need more, the passion or the centre?
Well, we need passion and we need imagination. And we need a passion about economic opportunity. I think one of the tragedies of Sean's essay is he actually got lost and didn't actually describe what's actually going on in terms of what voters are thinking. Voters also crave...
Well, what voters are thinking are clear in the election result. They're deserting
the
major parties and they're going for more passionate ideas on the left and the right, aren't they?
No. What people actually voted for the government to receive from the government was cost of living relief. And that is... principally about economic opportunity. Let me remind you that the most significant decision in the re-election of this government was the cancellation of the Stage 3 tax cuts and the use of those unfair tax cuts at the top spread across the bottom two-thirds of the population that set the groundwork for the economic opportunity debate in the election campaign. And I don't think there's any doubt that if you go back and look clearly at what happened in that election, the government's position improved considerably from there. And then they went through to the campaign and they were offering a very significant improvements in Medicare, which some people would describe as health policy. But what in fact it was cost of living relief, because it provided the certainty that people felt they needed in the future when it comes to their health care. So the package that we put forward, which was successful, was built on economic opportunity first and foremost.
Passion and imaginative policy are risky. They can make you a target in an election or in the lead up to an election. What's your advice to Anthony Albanese in terms of the balance, getting that balance right? Because one constant criticism of the Prime Minister is that he is playing it too safe.
Well,
he's too cautious because he wants that second term, because he believes that's how he embeds Labor into becoming the natural party of government.
Well, if people were to form the opinion that all he was doing was offering policies for a second term, then I think that would be disastrous for the government at the next election. But that's not what he's doing, and it's not what the government is doing. The government is getting ahead of the very big issues of the future, getting on with dealing with the energy transition, getting on with the Made in Australia program, and getting on with strengthening Medicare. All of those areas I regard as absolutely essential to the future economic opportunities in this country for all generations.
Wayne Swan is, of course, a former Labor Treasurer and a former federal member, long-time federal member for the seat of Lilly in Brisbane. He's these days a long-serving national president of the ALP. He joins me here on the Radio National Hour. Wayne Swan, your call to arms for the Labor Party earlier this year was, quote, to build our movement and make our party much more vibrant, larger and imaginative and contemporary.
Yep.
In other words, Labor's future success is predicated on recruiting less people who look like you, if I can put that respectfully. Is that a fair interpretation? What are you saying there?
Well, it would be a tragedy if they all looked like me. So, but let me put it this way. Our membership is ageing, and it's a very big challenge for our party, and it's a very big challenge for our movement. The largest cohort in the current membership of the ALP are those like myself who joined with Whitlam in 1974. So we've got a big task to increase not only just our membership, but also their participation. And I think this is the single biggest challenge that the party faces, and in some ways that the government faces. It's in a fantastic position to deal with it, because with 94 federal members of parliament, that we have an incredible group of people who are the public face of the Labor Party in their communities. And it's a great opportunity for them to go out and inspire people to participate in politics, whether it's to join the Labor Party or any other party, it is not really of the primary interest. We need to ensure much more participation in our political system if we are to avoid the trend to autocracy that we are seeing across so many other Western countries. Not just a question about the Labor Party, it's also a question about the Liberal Party and the National Party and their small memberships, their very small memberships. You could argue the Liberal Party's in dire straits right now, essentially because its membership has collapsed.
I go back to the truth that I've stated a number of times now, which is that the vote for the two major parties has collapsed. Why would younger Australians join a major party now when they're not even voting for you?
Well, I think they're voting more for Labor than they are for anyone else.
Yeah, but it's only 34%. It's about a third, and a third. It's not happy times for Labor either.
If you're adding up the votes of the left, it's pretty good for the Labor Party overall, but I agree with your substantive point. If we were to continue to have that trend, then there will be problems into the future. What I'm arguing is we need to revitalise, reinvigorate our political system, and part and parcel of that, just as essential as one vote, one value, compulsory voting, an independent electoral commission, and all of those things, just as important as all of those institutional things, is people's participation in politics. And then it comes to, well, where are they going to participate and how? I don't much mind, but we actually have to have a discussion about getting more people involved and talking about and getting out there, talking about the issues and joining political parties, whether it's the Labor Party or any other party.
Wainswan, let's just talk for a moment about your time in government, your legacy. In 2011, I think it was, you were named Euromoney Magazine's Finance Minister of the Year, which was quickly shortened to the world's greatest treasurer.
Yeah.
How does that label sit with you now?
Well, I'm really proud of what the Australian Labor Party did in government. I'm proud to have been the third longest serving Labor treasurer and to have avoided a catastrophe, not only in our economy, but also in our politics. Because everywhere else in the world, particularly in the United States and in Britain, where they didn't stimulate enough, they were left with a huge legacy of unemployment.
We're talking about through the GFC,
Coming out of the GFC, they were left with a huge legacy. And that led, first of all, in the United States to the rise of the Tea Party, and then it all morphed into what we're looking at today, which is Trumpism. You've seen the same happen in Britain where their stimulus wasn't big enough. There was immense human suffering around advanced economies in the aftermath of the GFC because governments had failed them. And the radicalisation on the extreme right has come from that across those economies. We've managed to avoid that so far. But I'm very proud of what we did during that period. And the legacy is there for all to see, whether it is the affordable housing we put in place, whether it is all the school halls, or whether it's the families that kept their jobs and kept their careers and kept their families together. It's a very substantial achievement for the Australian Labor Party, not only in Australian terms, but in world terms.
And a model that was emulated to some extent by the Morrison government during COVID, would you agree?
Yes, very badly, but they managed, having opposed our stimulus all the way through and having opposed carbon pricing and all of those things, they changed their stripes and went for deficit financing during COVID and then neglected to actually start sorting their budget out.
In terms of sorting their budget out, I mean, you were never able to deliver the surplus you promised, in part because of that massive stimulus package.
The deficits I left look pretty good compared to anything that the Liberal and Nationals have done or could have done. We ran a pretty tight fiscal ship when I was there, even at the end, and the one they were handed was in good nick. They then tried to blow up the system by massive cuts to health and education and so on, which ended badly for them.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is former Federal Treasurer Wainswan, who was granted life membership of the Labor Party over the weekend after many decades of active involvement at an official level in that party. As Treasurer, you also commissioned the Henry Tax Review in recognition that Australia's tax system was not fit for purpose. While Treasurer, you only implemented a few of the recommendations. Our tax system is still not fit for purpose. Should the Albanese Labor government, with its massive majority, dust off the Henry tax ideas, like the mining profits tax, for instance, and start forcing them through, start implementing them?
No, because we did actually implement a lot more of the Henry review than you've alluded to there, but I can't take the time to run through what we did do. But I do think that there has to be a discussion about about how we spend and raise our revenue, which must at some stage involve a discussion about whether the revenue take is high enough or not.
Which must at some stage either involve higher taxes or changing taxes and putting the tax burden somewhere else relying on bracket creep.
Can I just draw your attention to what I said before? When we cancelled the stage three tax cuts, which we thought were excessive at the top, and spread them around the bottom half of the income distribution, that was a very important thing to have done in terms of cost of living relief, but I think also in terms of how progressive a tax system do we want. So when you're looking at tax and when you're looking at expenditure, you've got to set the principle of how progressive you want the system to be and whether you deal with particular elements of the system which may be being abused or not working properly, just as Jim Chalmers has done with elements of superannuation.
Yeah, but there's big things sitting there that, you know, many groups and eminent economists have urged the government to do. They've urged them to do things like, you know, change the corporate tax structure, increase corporate taxes. They've urged them to get rid of things like negative gearing and the tax breaks on housing, capital gains
Fran,
tax.
Well, there was an election in 2019 which was fought on a number of those questions which were comprehensively rejected.
Does that mean Let's revisit those things?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that at all. It means as governments go through and budget and set their objectives as to what amount of revenue they need and what amount of spending they can afford, they will naturally go back and look at loopholes, if you like, in the system, and they may consider closing some. They may consider going through and approaching different lines of taxation differently. But
Urge them to get rid of bracket creep, for instance? Would you urge them in a time of a housing crisis to get rid of those tax breaks housing investors?
Well, no, I wouldn't. And that would be the wrong way to go about it. Because, as I said, we already had a debate about negative gearing, and that was a big thumbs down in 2019.
Times are pretty different now in terms of the housing crisis.
Certainly, and it may well be that the government, when it sits down and looks at future budgets, the government may well decide to adjust the balance between lines of taxation, the amount of taxation, and the expenditures that it's looking at. It's a perfectly normal course of action, which the current Treasurer has been through on a number of occasions and produced outcomes that you're calling for, namely the cancellation of stage three of the tax cuts a year and a half ago.
Since you left politics, you've been involved at an international level on trying to get agreement to force multinational corporations to pay minimum tax rate, for instance. At the last G7, the US backed out of that agreement, threatening a revenge tax, in fact, instead. How would you advise fellow G20 members and the Australian government to respond to the US at this time?
Well, firstly, also in government, we made major changes to international taxation and stopped an enormous amount of international tax evasion by some large Australian companies.
There's still a lot of international corporations dodging paying the rightful tax here, isn't there?
Well, I can tell you a lot more of them are paying a lot more tax now than they would have ever paid if we hadn't changed back then. There have been very, very big changes. But does that mean the international tax regime still doesn't need more attention? I think it probably will need some more attention, but it's not true to say that many international companies are now not paying any tax. They're paying a lot more tax now as a result of previous actions by the Labor government, and they have been built on by Jim Chalmers. It's a tragedy what the United States has done, trying to wreck the international agreements that were put in place, which our reforms were part of, through the G20. And they should be absolutely condemned for that action.
Condemnation is one thing, making them act is another thing.
Certainly.
Does it show that the G20, the G7, whoever it is, are just basically powerless in the face of Donald Trump and his tariff regime?
It shows what a wrecking ball Donald Trump can be to all of our international arrangements, of which tax is just one part.
Just finally, Wayne Swan, you said earlier, an honourable political life can change a country. In an honest moment, is that what you see when you look in the mirror?
Well, when I think about the events of the last sort of two decades, that if we hadn't put in place that very substantial stimulus and persevered in the face of fierce opposition, Australia would be a less fairer and less prosperous country.
So that's a yes?
Yep.
Wayne Swan, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Fran.
Wayne Swan is a former Federal Labor Treasurer who served as the member for Lilly in Brisbane for 23 years and as of last weekend is now a life member of the ALP. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Christmas is almost upon us, and let's face it, what's Christmas without the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra's annual Christmas concert, Noel Noel? Artistic director of the Brandenburg Orchestra, Paul Dyer, joins me now with a few members of the orchestra, I'm thrilled to say, along with the principal lutenist and guitarist Tommy Anderson, the mezzo-soprano Maria Eugenia Nieva, and classical guitarist Andrew Blanche. But first, Paul, it's great to have you back again here on Radio National.
I love being on your program, Fran. It's so great. So great to see you. And it's great to tell people about what's in store for Noel.
Well, every year the Brandenburg puts on a Christmas concert. I'm wondering if it's hard to stay fresh and surprising when the audience comes to you to this concert wanting of Christmas tradition, wanting some carols, wanting the spirit of Christmas. How do you reinvent this concert every year?
It's a really interesting question, Fran. I think over the years I've just realised that traditions have become more and more important. I mean, you know better than anyone that I have a tradition, and that's making my mother's Christmas cake. She died just before Christmas, and this recipe goes back 8 generations or 9 or 10 generations originally from Ireland. So that's a tradition that I hold. So when I'm composing the music or constructing the flavour for the year, I always think about keeping some of those traditions which we really love, but also introducing new flavours. And I think this year that's when I've really excelled.
Well, let's talk about that, because you're promising this year a night of peak altitude. How are you going to take us to new heights, Paul?
Well, I think the peak altitude comes with the two of the guests that we brought to the orchestra and the choir this year. And they came to me via a member of the orchestra, which is lovely, Eugenia, and who's a mezzo-soprano from Argentina, and then her partner, as it turns out, musical partner, but also in life, Andrew Blanche, and Andrew plays the classical guitar, both absolutely breathtakingly brilliant musicians. And so we've decided on the flavour, because Eugenia's from Argentina, to have a Spanish flavour for Noel this year.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is the Artistic Director of the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra, Paul Dyer, and assorted orchestra members, which I'm very excited about. Paul, the Brandenburg Orchestra celebrates its 36th anniversary in January. You founded this orchestra when you were just in your 30s. Do you feel like you've grown up with the Brandenburg Orchestra?
I mean, I remember the first concert, Fran, in the Opera House and on the concert hall stage, and at the end, when the whole of the concert hall rises to its feet for your very first concert, and that beautiful feeling of happiness. The happiness has remained in every single concert over those 36 years. And I feel very proud today, because with me is Tommy Anderson, that you'll speak to in a moment, I think. And Tommy was there at that very first concert too. And so there's a great sense of pride, of warmth, of artistry growing up, of learning about how to tackle different situations, different music, genres, try to cross over as much as I can. For example, we had Indigenous works in the last and new works composed for the last series. So it's been easy to try and keep on the flow.
Do you feel like the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra now has found its place, made its place in Australian classical music?
Definitely, yes.
And how hard was that?
Well, I think it's because of passion and resilience. Having a great team of people, Bruce Applebaum, who founded the orchestra with me, is the brains behind it. I'm the artist and I'm in control of the music. But, you know, we've won 6 ARIA awards now, and I think that's because people have seen a genre of music that basically I pioneered here in this country and brought this music on period instruments to an audience who were receptive and open and hungry for it. So I feel immense gratitude.
You and I have talked a lot over the years, Paul. You've always had a sense of fun about you, and I think brought that to the orchestra. You've talked about, you know, happiness, but how important is having fun to the mission of the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra?
Well, I'd say it's right up in the top, you know, percentage, Fran, because we're here on this earth to love, enjoy, whether it's a taste, whether it's something we wear, whether it's a person. And then because we're artists on stage, there's an old tradition in the 19th century which meant that everyone keeps their head down, they look at the music and they don't look at the conductor. They see it in peripheral vision. I look at Tommy and I say, are you enjoying yourself? Show the audience that you're enjoying yourself. Show your colleagues. Let them enjoy you. We're a family together, this group of, you know, 50 or so musicians of the Brandenburg, the choir and the orchestra. I want immense joy, immense happiness and immense fun.
Well, Tommy, you're leaving the family. You've been with the orchestra for the full 36 years. How do you feel about this being your last Christmas concert with the Brandenburg Orchestra?
I must say I feel a little bit sad about it because it's been a major part of my life. But I think there comes a time in your life when you feel it's the right time.
How have you expanded in those years? You're the lutenist for the orchestra, you play guitar. Have you expanded your own expertise over this time?
Absolutely. I think it's part of being in the orchestra is that you always make sure you develop personally.
And do you too remember that first concert at the Sydney Opera House?
Absolutely, yes. It was a great experience. I think we all felt that we had done something very special, and the audience reaction confirmed that. So it was a very uplifting experience. We could feel that we had started something quite unique.
And they keep on coming. Yeah. So, Paul, I guess you'll be advertising for a new lute player next year.
Well, actually, the succession plan has been there for a little while now. Nick Pollock's going to follow in Tommy's footsteps. He's from Melbourne. He's a young bloke. You know, he's got the rock star thing that Tommy still has, where he started, you know, his career as a rock guitarist and then found period music. And I think Nick's there, and we've got beautiful Hannah Lane who plays the period harp as well. And you know, I've got a guest, wonderful guest guitarist in this series, that Andrew, who's there. You never know, we might turn him over to the period guitar and the oboe and lute as well.
I'll leave that to you to negotiate. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Paul Dyer. He's the founding artistic director of the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra. We have Christmas to celebrate coming up before we get to 2026. This year, Noel Noel, as you mentioned, has a bit of Spanish theme to it. So just tell me a bit more about the concert.
So what I'd like to do is intersperse moments of crescendo and release all the time. Or I've worked out this wonderful formula of where people need to feel surprised. They love fast playing and they loved soft, slow playing. They love to feel nostalgic. They love to feel new energy. People, if you take a selfie on stage to 1,000 people, people, it doesn't matter what age they are, they leap up and want to be part of the photograph. So this year I've decided to take all of the moments of Eugenia and Andrew together, add some old, really old, ancient Spanish carols, actually, which Eugenia is going to kind of lead the singing for the choir. But I also wanted to do some beautiful stuff like Palestrina, you know, ancient Renaissance music as well, some modern stuff as well. And I can't control the audience, but when we get to O Come All You Faithful at the very end of the concert, people immediately start to sing. I don't ask them to sing, they just want to. And so there's this
wonderful. We all want to sing carols at Christmas.
Yeah. And so all of it, we've got this lovely moment where grandparents who have been brought up with the Brandenburg now, Fran, are bringing their grandchildren. And so all of these kids don't know about carols really. And so they're just all learning about what is a Christmas carol to our generation and why is it beautiful and why is it nostalgic. And I can hear Mariah Carey singing O Holy Night, but this year we're going to hear Eugenia singing it in Spanish. I mean, it's going to be awesome.
It's going to be awesome. Well, you've got a crew here. Tell us who we have and what they're going to play for us.
Well, Eugenia, as I mentioned, is a mezzo-soprano. She comes from Argentina. And so I said to her and Andrew, can you bring us some really special piece of music that lifts the roof off any one of these Noel concerts? It's a piece which is an Argentine written. It's like a folk song, and it's just uplifting and beautiful.
I can't wait to have a listen. That was Paul Dyer, the artistic director, the founding artistic director of the Brandenburg Orchestra with Tommy Anderson. And some tickets are still available to see this concert, Noel Noel, in Melbourne at 7:30 on this Saturday and in Sydney on Saturday the 13th of December. That's it from me for today. Remember, come and find us if you've missed anything and you want to catch it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. In the meantime, let's go into the evening with some of the stars of the Brandenburg Orchestra. This is El Sueño de la Vendimia, that's the Dream of the Harvest, performed by Maria Eugenia Nieva and Andrew Blanche. Have a great night.
De las altas cumbres desciende el agua, abrazado el rumbo de las acequias. De las altas cumbres desciende el agua, abrazando el rumbo de las acequias. Río de amor, vendimiador, madre de la cosecha. Río de amor, vendimiador, madre de la cosecha. Madre de las uvas, heredosa y tierna, esa tierra vía gestando el vino. Rayo de sol, su corazón canta por el racimo. Rayo de sol, su corazón canta por el racimo. Mientras el sonido de las guitarras despereza cuecas en su alegría. Sembrador de peras pasó el granizo, deshojando el verde de las hileras. Sembrador de peras pasó el granizo, deshojando el verde de las hileras. ¿Quién fue ese azul para encender cielos de primavera? ¿Quién fue ese azul para encender cielos de primavera? Por las alamedas de la vendimia, alumbrando el vino se va febrero. Plena y frutal inmensidad, sueños esos labriegos. Plena y frutal inmensidad, sueños esos labriegos. Mientras el sonido de las guitarras desperezan cuecas en su alegría. Ebria de luz, pinta la vid, el viento de la vida. Ay, ebria de luz, pinta la vid, el viento de la vida.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.